The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Our next guest, Laura Kennedy, has written a really interesting book called Some of Our Parts, which looks at the complexity of the identity labels which we take on and which she has taken on. She is a philosopher as well as a writer. I think that very much comes across in the book, Some of Our Parts. Laura, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What inspired you to write this book and to take this approach?
I think I've just observed, like most of us, increasingly over the last 10 to 15 years, that we've become a very labels-obsessed culture. And a lot of the ways that we connect with each other, particularly online, necessitate that we present ourselves for the sort of consumption of other people through lists of words, labels that we use to describe ourselves.
Such as in when people are putting up a post on social media, dating apps, or even their LinkedIn page.
Yes, yeah. Any sort of social media bio that you might have, it's kind of a necessity to describe the basic elements of yourself. You'll list a bunch of words. But we have a tendency to kind of sometimes reduce ourselves to those identities, and definitely to do it with other people. And I think I just kind of had this growing awareness that as I aged and moved through the world more and more, certain identity labels started to pinch. They didn't fit anymore. I wanted to change them or let them go. And then there's the conflict that we all have with the identity labels that were given. So one of the experiences that really made me consider, for example, the label of Irishness was emigrating, because you kind of profoundly become Irish when you leave Ireland.
You went to Australia about a year ago, because you've been writing in the Irish Times about this, about your experiences there. But tell us a little bit more. I mean, did you become more Irish in a sense when you were abroad?
Well, before that, I lived in London for 5 years. So I don't just mean the kind of the element of where you go abroad and you start liking Damien Dempsey 68% more, which is a definite phenomenon. But I mean the kind of the Irishness walks into the room in front of you. It's the first thing people hear. It's the lens through which everyone suddenly sees you, because it's what marks you as different from everyone else. And so it becomes this kind of identity that you have to wear whether you choose to or not. It's always relevant whether you want it to be or not. And you have to navigate that sense that other people view you through this label.
And have you been comfortable with that? I mean, do you feel that you're defined to others as being Irish?
When I'm outside of Ireland, yes. But I mean, we all have those elements. Any room in which you are any kind of minority, any scenario in which one element of your identity becomes an object of curiosity or interest to other people. And it can be positive attention too, but it can still feel quite limiting and quite flattening.
But if you're defined as Irish, what does that actually even mean? Because not all Irish people are the same.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's kind of what I'm getting at with the book, which is that labels can be this wonderful means of connection and a kind of shortcut to explaining who we are to people. But they can also be this incredibly restrictive and limiting thing. And one of the interesting debates in the country, especially as someone who's been gone for a year, of course I keep up, but having come back, is there is an ongoing strange and interesting conversation in the context of a changing Ireland about what it means to be Irish. What are the necessary, the sufficient conditions to being Irish? Who gets to decide and on behalf of whom? And so I think that conversation really proves, along with a lot of other ones, that labels are important and how we think about them matters.
Because it's interesting, you write about when your cousins used to come home to Limerick from England and they regarded themselves as Irish, and yet you didn't think of them that way.
No, I mean, they had Irish parents and they were, you know, sort of describing to me when we were small children in sort of the flat London clipped accent, you know, I'm Irish like you. And there was something about it that, I mean, I suppose maybe the Irish educational system doesn't necessarily help, because that was in and around the age where we were starting to learn about colonialism and you'd be carrying a bit of a resentment as a result of that. But it felt like a real resonant truth to me that they couldn't be what I was because they sounded different. They didn't pass, as it were. But obviously, having grown up and thought much more carefully about identity, accents are quite cosmetic. You know, heritage is complicated, and we do have a sort of a, we have an element of Ireland of, say, somebody particularly, if they have the unfortunate quality of a British accent, they could live here for 70 years and we'll tell them they're not one of us. And I'm not sure that we're entitled to do that after such a long time.
You also focus in, and I find this very interesting, about why you no longer call yourself a feminist, because I think similarly, I mean, feminism means so many things to so many different women, doesn't it?
Yes, and that one's a tricky one. And I was a bit nervous writing the book and talking about that label, that because we live in such a flat, black and white world, and this is a grey book, it's for people who live in the grey, that I was going to present this book to a bunch of women who would decide that because I'm saying I'm not a feminist, it means in some way that I hate women, which would obviously be a really difficult self-defeating position for me to hold as one of them. But I kind of talk about the history of feminist thought in the book and my own kind of millennial upbringing inside lipstick feminism, and the kind of myth that you can have everything as a woman. And just kind of come to realize that because feminism now can be anything, it can be everything, it doesn't mean anything, really. So when another woman tells me I'm a feminist, I don't automatically know what she means. She might mean any one of a million different, often conflicting positions. So I was talking to a journalist recently about the book, and she seemed quite irritated just by the sentence that, you know, I don't identify as a feminist. And she said, I'm very proud to be a feminist. And I said, okay, what do you mean by that? And the fact that I didn't automatically know, I think, means that the word in some sense has lost its power.
So it's been devalued.
I think so. At least it's less useful to us if you want to use it as a tool of progress.
But do you have a definition of feminism that means that all other versions become excluded?
No. That's kind of why I've taken off the coat and set it down, because one of the really important elements of labels, I think, and what I've tried to do here in the book, in part why I have examined my own labels, is because you can do that rigorously with your own. You can be unkind toward your own labels, but it's not really an entitlement we have with other people's. So I'm kind of trying to approach other people's labels with compassion. So I'm not going around telling anyone else what they can be or how they can identify, but I'm being pretty strict with myself about the labels that I carry, why I choose to carry them, why I identify with them.
I wonder how much people actually think about whether they live up to how they self-describe, or whether they just actually put it down on a list for a dating app or for a job application without really subscribing to what they're saying about themselves.
I think, well, I talk a little bit in the book about John Stuart Mill and his work on liberty, and how we have a tendency to reproduce the norms of the society in which we live, because we just sort of presuppose that if everyone thinks something is good, that must mean it is. They've done the working out, and we can just, you know, run straight to the answer. And I think you've kind of got at something there, which is, in a sense, you know, if you ask someone a question or you push them on questions of identity in a very polite and maybe very value neutral, curious, open-minded way, a lot of the time people will get very defensive and irritated, because I think often we don't know why we hold the positions that we hold. And when pushed to explain it, we have to retroactively either invent a reason for, you know, cleaving so hard to that identity that maybe used to fit or doesn't fit now. Or we have to kind of let it go and change our mind. And that requires, you know, real deliberative thought process, which is hard when everyone has bills to pay and you need to iron your trousers and your children don't sleep and life is difficult.
Let's talk about something else, neurodiversity. Mm. And that's a word which I think to many people is new in recent times. We've had more conversations about autism and ADHD and various other life conditions that people live with. And neurodiversity is now the way it's been described, I suppose, in a broader umbrella for various conditions. So talk to me a little bit about living with one of those conditions and how you identify with that. And then separately, we'll get to maybe how others put labels on people in relation to neurodiversity.
Yeah, so I think it is a relatively new label for a lot of people, and it carries a lot of preconceptions, particularly in relation to gender. You know, I kind of write in the book about most people's mental image of an autistic person as a man in creased trousers who's really into train timetables and, you know, possibly spectacularly unsuccessful on the dating scene, which is obviously a very unfair stereotype. There are many autistic men who don't fit that that stereotype, but it's even less fair sort of for women. It's a very bad attribution for them. But I went for diagnosis at the age of 34 and sat on the label kind of for a year and a half after it, thinking about it before I wrote this book, because I was kind of observing how it was being used by people around me, how it was being talked about, the preconceptions that it carries. And I've seen a lot of people sort of gain this label and then sort of recast the entire story of their life in light of it, look back on their childhood and sort of in some ways feel harmed and wronged retroactively. You know, I wasn't guided at school. My needs weren't met. I struggled to make friends because I had special requirements or my brain works differently. I'm not like everybody else. And that can kind of leave a sense of having been wronged or a sense of injustice. And I'm just not interested in doing that. I don't think it would help me at all. I don't see how it would.
So I want to be very careful in how I phrase this in case anyone takes mm-hmm. offense. And I don't mean this in any way to be offensive, but could it be that for some people that a late diagnosis can allow them to make excuses for bad decisions or bad choices or bad actions that they've taken in the past?
I think any pathologized label can be used in that way. The same goes for mental health labels. However, I think it is important to say one of the reasons that I elect to wear this label very lightly is because there are, obviously, as you pointed out, neurodiversity is a vast spectrum, an umbrella under which many kinds of people stand. And there are many people who stand under that umbrella who do not have the capacity to pass whole jobs, do things that everybody else can do without huge stigmatization and difficulty. And the label's incredibly important for them. It communicates something really meaningful. And so for somebody like me, who can kind of, you know, muddle along, sometimes erroneously, but I get by fine. It doesn't seem as necessary, and I don't want to lean on it in the same way. But it is interesting and important context to keep in mind. So when it comes to kind of pathologized labels, there is a temptation when you get a diagnosis of any kind, I think, to box yourself into that definition of your capacity, of your potential, of your future, as well as your past and present, and decide that it delineates your ability to be different. And it doesn't necessarily have to in all cases.
But how do other people then treat you when you identify as such and have not previously said that you're neurodiverse? Do people treat you differently? Or
I think because it's relatively misunderstood, there is a decent amount of skepticism around it, especially when people are there's sort of a bigotry of low expectation, I think, around autism. People expect if someone is articulate, if they're high functioning, if they have a decent intellect, if they have a relatively good job, people sort of think, well, you're not really autistic, are you? Because you're fine. But obviously being autistic doesn't mean being not fine. It just...
Does it mean an enormous amount of effort?
This is one of the things I explore in the book, where I talk socially about the kind of challenges, for example, that I as a woman feel in female dominated environments where, you know, women as a category, there are so many individual exceptions, of course, but in general, they have very high social intelligence. They're very astute political organizers. They do an awful lot of communicating that's not direct and verbal. And that can be hard to read as a woman who fits the sort of traits of an autistic person. But then I kind of think about all the people I know who are not, you know, don't identify as neurodiverse, and they too can come home from, you know, Charlotte's birthday party and feel completely exhausted. So I don't know, and as though they've performed another version of themselves to kind of get through the evening. So we all do that to an extent. But I think it can bring its difficulties, but I don't really like to view myself through that one label without, you know, excluding all of the others that matter.
Just to finish, just to summarize, and this terrific read, some of our parts, should we put labels on ourselves, or should we reject labels, and should we reject other people trying to put labels on us?
I don't think we can move through the world rejecting other people putting labels on us, because they're going to anyway. You know, anything that sort of requires telling everyone else what they're not allowed to do is a real energy and time suck. It's not going to work out. People will label us. They're going to. So I think it's the same with the ones we identify with, to kind of wear them lightly, to view them as describing us, but not, you know, being prescriptive, something that we have to almost perform and live up to and become trapped inside. The idea that labels can change is really important. And it also gives us a freedom to understand how other people see us, but maintain the right to change if we want to, if we need to.
Laura Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us. Some of Our Parts is the book.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.